First time I preached a sermon here, I gesticulated wildly and flung my mic and the little clip across the stage. We're going to try to not repeat that. Does anybody here read a lot of books? Some. I did a quick count at our house, just purely an estimate, and on the various shelves in our house, we have between 1,500 and 2,000 books, and on a quick eyeball, I don't think there's more than two dozen that have not been read, and some of them have been read more than a dozen times. Angela, usually my wife, usually has an upstairs book and a downstairs book. One that she reads during breakfast or after work, and then one upstairs where she reads in bed. And sometimes she actually has an outside book for the back deck. If you read novels or biographies, you might be familiar with a character type known as a developing character or a dynamic character. This can be the main person in the story, but it's not necessarily the main person in the story. The dynamic character is the person who changes over the course of the plot. They show up once in a while throughout the course of the book. You get to check in on them, and through them, you get a picture of the whole story. Some examples. Gimli the dwarf in Lord of the Rings. He starts out as a dwarf nationalist and a racist, and then through struggle, he becomes friends with Legolas the elf, and he swears allegiance to an elf queen and Galadriel, and it comes to love elves so much that they allow him to spend eternity in the elf version of heaven. Star-Lord, Peter Quill in The Guardians of the Galaxy. He starts the story as an orphan. He's then kidnapped by aliens. He grows up to become a thief, and then he becomes a hero and the savior of the universe. Ebenezer Scrooge, Petruchio in Taming of the Shrew, Neville Longbottom. The most great stories have a dynamic character whose life changes as the story develops. Today we're going to talk about the dynamic character in the book of John. His name is Nicodemus. Before we meet him, let's talk about what's happened so far in John. In John 2, Jesus does his first miracle, turns water into wine. He didn't think it was time to break out his message. His mom, Mary, says, oh, yes, it is. And so he does the miracle. Cat's out of the bag. It's time, whether he wants to do it or not. He leaves Nazareth, and he's doing miracles, and he's teaching in Jerusalem, and he gets noticed. Then John 3 starts, and Nicodemus has some questions. This is a painting called Jesus and Nicodemus. It's by Kieran Hendrick Vollmerin. I don't know if you know anything about Mennonite last names, but Kieran is the basis for the last name Queering. Not that it matters. This was painted sometime between 1616 and 1645. He's a Dutch painter, which is why Kieran sounds so familiar. And you notice that Nicodemus here is wearing 17th century European clothes. He did not have those. But he does have a turban on, which probably is accurate, although it's plaid, and I'm not sure if that's accurate or not. It's very common to show Jesus and Nicodemus in this sort of a setting, where they're hunched over a table, there's some candles, there's books open, like it's some kind of secret Bible study or a tutoring session. This could very easily have taken place in a garden. Jesus spent lots of nights outside having visions and getting arrested. John 3 doesn't actually tell us where this takes place. It just tells us about a person. So who is Nicodemus? He doesn't appear in any other historical record. There is a writing called The Gospel of Nicodemus, and that has been around at least 1,600 years, but we're not sure when it was written. It seems to have been written down, and then Nicodemus's name was tagged onto it to make it seem important. But very few people take it seriously as a history. And so, for all practical purposes, John is our only source. Nicodemus shows up in chapter 3, he shows up in chapter 7, and he shows up again in chapter 19. Every time we see Nicodemus, it's in some sort of private meeting. So that raises a question. How does John know about these meetings? John probably got the information from Nicodemus. At some point, they became friends. And here's what John says about him. It's 27 AD, John 3, verse 1. First verse I'm going to read in ESV. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. So what's the first thing it says? There was a man. John's not making a point about him being a man. I'm going to make a point about him being a man. It's easy to read a book like the Bible, get familiar with it, then you dissect it, and you interpret it, and you're in church a long time, and you hear the stories over and over. And it is literature, so it's easy to forget that the characters in it were also people. There are things like parables, of course, that are fictional moral stories, but there are also stories of real people with real lives. They had spouses, they had children, they had jobs, unique ways of seeing things. They're as real as you are. So let's start by saying this is not a parable. It's in Nicodemus' story, there was a man. Man, the Greek word is anthropos. If you're an anthropologist, what do you study? You study people. If you're an archaeological anthropologist, do you study real men like Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals and European caves, or do you study the Flintstones? You study real people, anthropos. Nicodemus is a man, and he's real. What's the next thing it says? There was a man of the Pharisees. Pharisee. Pharisaos. What's a Pharisee? Most of the Pharisees you see in the Bible, it's almost like a, almost uses a derogatory term, like, oh, the Pharisees and the Sadducees said this. They're always the bad guys, but Pharisees are just a combined religious order and political party. It's like saying a Republican Baptist or a Democrat Methodist or a Green Party Mennonite. Pharisaeus just means separatist. So some people like the Sadducees, they were elitists, priests of privilege. They're open to being a part of the Roman Empire. They, for the sake of power, they're willing to collaborate. Pharisees, though, wanted Jews to be culturally separate from the Romans. Even if they had to live with them, they wanted to be culturally separate. So Pharisees were more popular with the common people. They were more progressive. Best estimates are that there were 70,000 people in Jerusalem at this time, and that 7,000 of them were Pharisees. So about 1 in 10. Nicodemus is a Pharisee. He's a separatist. What's the next thing it says? There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus. Nicodemus means victorious among his people, or triumph of the public. We're not sure, and I don't know if this is the name his parents gave him or not. It could be a name he actually earned later. It would make sense that a Pharisee, a separatist, would have a name like, these people, our people will be victorious. So it fits kind of his religio-political standing. That's a big word. But his name describes who he is. The next thing. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a member of the Jewish ruling council. Probably what that means is Nicodemus is one of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the Greek word. Those who sit together. These were 23 men who acted as criminal judges. They settled religious disputes. They helped run politics in every Israeli city. This is a drawing of what the Sanhedrin would look like. There should be 23 men in that, and you can see the two lawyers arguing their cases here. So that's what the Sanhedrin looked like. So Nicodemus was a man with a real life, a family, a job. He was a Pharisee, a separatist. He was respected and trusted enough to sit with the Sanhedrin, basically the Supreme Court. But even though he had authority, he was a champion of the commoners. So that's Nicodemus. You ever experienced this? You are doing what you think you're supposed to do with your life. You're following the cultural rules for success. You have the right job. You've picked out the right church. You have the right friends. And you look up one day and you realize it's not working for you. Nicodemus had an established existence. He had solid views on politics, on religion, on culture. And then he hears some rumors coming from the market. And he begins to wonder. And Jesus is about to wreck Nicodemus' established existence. Angela is an engineer with the Department of Transportation. She has 25 years experience as a traffic safety specialist. So when she tells you something about traffic safety, you take it to the bank. She'll tell you that what the public thinks will make them safer is often exactly what doesn't make them safer. Examples. Emails from the public. Dear Mrs. Cargill, I'm typing. People are speeding past my house. You need to lower the speed limit. And Angela will have to tell them, lowering the speed limit will kill you. Dear Mrs. Cargill, there's a dangerous intersection in front of my house. It's the most dangerous intersection in the state of Oregon. The solution is you need to put in a traffic signal. And Angela has to tell them, a traffic signal there will kill you. And one that comes in an awful lot. Dear Mrs. Cargill, I need to get across the highway safely. You need to put in a crosswalk. You'll die. There's a perception problem. People see painted crosswalks and think the lines on the ground are force fields. They say, this is a safe place to cross. If I cross here, everyone will stop for me. But paint gives you no safety whatsoever if a driver doesn't see the lines and decide to stop. Nicodemus is a man who believes his path is laid out. He knows the politics of that path. He knows the theology of that path. He knows the rules of that path. And he trusts the safety of the path. Then he hears Jesus, and he realizes his crosswalk is just lines painted on the ground. Jesus has no interest in stopping. Nicodemus' well-defined life isn't going to keep him safe. John 3, 1 and 2. This is an NIV now. Now there was a Pharisee, a man named Nicodemus, who was a member of the Jewish ruling council. He came to Jesus at night and said, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the signs you are doing if God were not with him. He came to Jesus at night. Here's the crosswalk. This is a painting called Christus und Nicodemus by Fritz von Ude. It was painted in 1886, German, clearly. Jesus always seemed to be dressed like the familiar Jesus in his robe. But Nicodemus, again, here is in clothes that match the painter's nationality and their time frame. He's got a professor's robe on. He has a collared shirt and a tie. He actually looks a little like Sigmund Freud, which is the right place and the right time frame. And I'm not meaning to mock that. If showing Nicodemus as a regular person helps someone remember that he was, that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to remember that he's real. Why come to Jesus at night? Was he too busy during the day? Did he have a date? Was Jesus hiding in the basement and he couldn't find him until nighttime? More likely, he came at night for the exact reason that you think he came at night. He didn't want to be seen. He wanted to clear up a few things before he brought Jesus up in public, before he made it official that he was looking into it. Rabbi, we know you're a teacher who has come from God. Well, who's we? Did all 7,000 Pharisees get together and say, Nicodemus, go ask Jesus some questions in the middle of the night? Or did all 23 members of the Sanhedrin put out some kind of subpoena where they needed to get some questions answered in the middle of the night? In chapter 2, Jesus drove profiteers out of the temple with a whip. He's not popular with the powerful. They're not interested in what he has to say. I think Nicodemus is using the royal we. We, meaning me. Or maybe he and one or two other people that he trusted. We know. And Jesus has a habit of answering people's questions with cryptic answers, and he gives Nicodemus one of the most maddening answers of all time. John 3:3, Jesus replied, "Very truly, I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again." Remember, we have the rest of the New Testament. We have 2,000 years of interpretation working for us that back us up to understand what is going on here. we know things that Nicodemus doesn't. We understand that being born again is a metaphor. You hear about Jesus, you read the things he did, the things he said, you believe they're true, and then you change. You become a new person because believing those things changes you. God changes you. You're not just a physical person anymore, you're a spiritual person. You're born again. That's what it means. Nicodemus has no idea what Jesus is talking again about here. Born again? Can you picture his face? Born again? John 3:4. How can someone be born when they're old? Nicodemus asked. Surely they cannot enter a second time into their mother's womb to be born. That makes no sense. What are you talking about? Let me pause for a second and remind you that asking questions does not make God mad. Half of the Psalms are poems full of author complaints and questions. Jesus' teachings are often just him responding to questions. He made the questioners into the founders of the church. Questions don't make God mad. If you don't understand, ask. James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. So God is not afraid of questions, and he's not afraid of doubt. In fact, if God did not have answers to all the questions people posed him, he wouldn't be much of a God. He would not be worthy of your time. The answers can be challenging to your thinking, of course. They can be cryptic, like this one. You won't understand them right away, but ask your questions. Nicodemus asks questions, and Jesus answers. John 3:5-7. Jesus answered, "Very truly, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born of water and of the Spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, but spirit gives birth to spirit. You should not be surprised at me saying you must be born again." So this is a little less cryptic. He's easing Nicodemus into this. It's a fuller explanation of being born again. And hopefully Nicodemus at this point is tracking a little better with the explanation. And then John 3:8 happens. The wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. And I can just picture Nicodemus scratching his eyes out. Give me a straight answer. Jesus isn't making it easy on him. Remember, this is the Iron Age. At the time, people did not know what caused wind. Does anybody here watch the Weather Channel? Have you been tracking the hurricanes coming up the East Coast? How about when Typhoon Tsonga came to Oregon last fall? Did you watch the Weather Channel and track it coming in? Did you make any preparations? We know where it came from. We know what causes wind. We know about the rising and falling of air masses, the effects of sun and water and land on the atmosphere. We have forecasts that are available for weeks ahead of time sometimes. They will tell us when the storm's coming. First century Israelites watched the clouds that they could see, but they were not much better at predicting weather than Winnie the Pooh. Tut, tut, looks like rain. That's as far as it got. This metaphor of the wind doesn't really work that well for us because it depends on mystery. Wind's not a mystery to us anymore. We've ruined it by learning something. But at the same time, the idea of, at that time, the idea of the atmosphere was like magic. They couldn't see it. They didn't know where wind came from, what caused it. They didn't know what air was made of or what made it move. And that's how it is with the Spirit of God. And that's a mystery that has not stopped being a mystery to us. So the idea here is this is a mystery. Remember what we said about Nicodemus having a well-ordered life, about his crosswalk stripes on the ground? He had the illusion of control. Jesus told him if he wanted to see the kingdom, he needed to follow mysteries outside of the lines he'd painted. You cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. This is a modern painting from Cameroon. This is Jesus and Nicodemus. It's painted by Jesus Maffa. This is another example of people making the story part of their own culture. You can see, I think there's some kind of a metaphor with these jars being emptied here. Those are all tipped over as though things are pouring out. just a guess. Nicodemus hears about the wind. John 3:9. How can this be? I don't get it. I don't get it. Now, and it would have been easy enough for a man like Nicodemus to make himself sound smart. All right, as he nods. In school, I was a master test taker. I am the best test taker you have ever met. I am not saying I'm the smartest person you've ever met. I'm saying I'm the best test taker ever. Most talented of all time. I could work my way through any subject if it was a test, especially essay questions. I took a high school biology test, my AP bio test, and there was a half-hour essay that I was supposed to write about Gregor Mendel. And this is a man who basically invented modern genetics. He did it by crossbreeding pea plants and registering the colors and things like that. What comes when you breed a red pea plant with a white pea plant and things like that. I could not remember at all what Gregor Mendel did. Could not remember. I thought he was crossbreeding something. Was it mice? And I decided I'm going to go with mice, but I'm not going to talk about mice. So I spoke about his experiments, never mentioned what he was experimenting on. I passed the test. I got college credit from that test. And here's the thing. That method of study did not serve me well in college. I dropped out. 20 years later, I decided that I wanted to finish college. I went back. I studied like mad. My degree depended on me knowing all about Gregor Mendel. And I know about Gregor Mendel and his peas now. There's a difference between a person who wants to look smart and a person who really wants understanding. The person who wants understanding keeps asking questions. John 3:10-11. You are Israel's teacher, said Jesus, and you do not understand these things? Very truly, I tell you, we speak of what we know, and we testify to what we have seen. But still, you people do not accept our testimony. So you're Israel's teacher, and you don't understand. There's another thing to know about Nicodemus. He was a teacher, didaskalos. It means master or doctor. You're in charge of knowing things. And here's something you don't know. Let's move out of the crosswalk. Jesus, again, not being thrown by questions, not being mad about being asked questions. He's just pointing out to Nicodemus that despite all his training, despite his role in leadership, he's still missing basic information. But because Nicodemus keeps asking questions, Jesus keeps answering questions. They're moving forward. We're moving here. Let's keep this rolling. He explains that he's going to be crucified in verse 14 and lifted up in the desert. He explains why God sent him in verse 16. He explains how believing the things he says are the dividing point between pretend safety and real safety in verses 17 and 18. And in verse 19, he says, this is the verdict. Nicodemus is a judge, remember. This is language Nicodemus understands. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what they have done has been done in the sight of God. What time did Nicodemus come to see Jesus? At night. This is a painting by Henry Asawa Tanner. It was painted in 1899. Tanner's mom escaped slavery through the Underground Railroad. And he studied art in Paris. This is a study for a more detailed painting that he did later, but I actually like, I prefer the sketchiness of this. The faces aren't clear. He uses the tradition of giving your religious leaders a halo. And you notice in this one that Jesus has his halo. Nicodemus doesn't have one yet. That's because Nicodemus is still figuring this out. I also love that this is nighttime and Jesus' halo doubles as the moon. So Jesus talks about nighttime. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light. Jesus is making a broader point about people doing evil, but I don't think he's condemning Nicodemus here. He's not saying, you're evil because it's nighttime. That's too much of a leap. This is a challenge to Nicodemus. He said, it's like Jesus looking at the black sky outside and saying, whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what they have done has been done in the sight of God. Nicodemus, next time, come openly. Come in the daytime. Don't hide the fact you're still looking for answers. Ask your questions openly. And Nicodemus does that. He shows up again in John's book. This is 29 AD, 2 years later, John 7. Let me remind you what Jesus did here earlier in the book. He starts in Cana in the north, turns water into wine at the wedding. Then he marches south to Jerusalem, where he clears the money changers out of the temple with a whip, and he meets Nicodemus. Then he goes north to Galilee, passes through Samaria, meets the woman at the well, heals the official son. South to Jerusalem, heals a man at the Bethesda pool, gets in trouble for healing on the Sabbath. North to Galilee, feeds the 5,000, walks on water. South to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. North and south and north and south. It's like John is writing the story as though Jesus is pacing. He's winding himself up for something. He'd already had threats on his life. He could have stayed in Galilee and probably been safe. But he knew Jerusalem needed him. So Jesus shows up in Jerusalem, and the chief priests hear about it, and they send guards to grab him. John 7, 45 to 52. Finally, the temple guards went back to the chief priests and the Pharisees and asked them, why didn't you bring him in? No one ever spoke the way this man does, the guards replied. You mean he has deceived you also? The Pharisees retorted. Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? No. But this mob that knows nothing of the law, there is a curse on them. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier and who was one of their own number, asked, does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he has been doing? They replied, are you from Galilee too? Look into it and you will find that a prophet does not come out of Galilee. So what did the chief priests ask him? Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? No, but this mob that knows nothing of the law, there's a curse on them. Do you know anybody who's a ruler or a Pharisee? They got it wrong. At least one ruler and Pharisee believed. And he was one of their own. Or at least he was trying. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier and who was one of their own number, asked, does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he has been doing? Nicodemus, the dynamic character, he's changing. You know, he's no longer questioning at night in secret rooms. He's questioning in front of his colleagues, the people he was hiding from in John 3. He's reminding his friends about their dedication to justice, about what they're supposed to be doing for a living. He looks at the way his friends look at the way his friends ask these questions and then realize that they answer them immediately in the way that they want it to be answered. Does any of the rulers of the Pharisees believe? No! When Nicodemus asks the questions, he just asks the question and he waits for an answer. People who truly want understanding, they keep asking. 30 AD, this is John 19. Jesus stays around Jerusalem. He's escalating miracles, escalating his teaching. He's escalating the conflict. Eventually, Jesus is killed for his trouble. This is John 19, 38. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, he feared the Jewish leaders. He's where Nicodemus was in John 3. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night, in case you were confused with some other Nicodemus. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. This is Michelangelo's Lamentation over the Dead Christ. And it was sometime between 1547 and 1555. And we think that this hooded figure at the top is supposed to be Nicodemus. So the Sanhedrin judged Jesus, and then Nicodemus buried him. He buried him expensively. He buried him with care. And remember, Nicodemus didn't know about Easter. He's actively honoring the person his cohorts had just killed. He has no reason to expect anything good to come from it. He's not winding up for Sunday morning. He's not safe inside the lines anymore. He's not worried about the safety. He's somewhere new. He doesn't know which way the wind's blowing. He just knows that he needs to bury Jesus and do it right. This is a stained glass window in the old Hunstanton St. Mary Church in Norfolk, England. This is the two Marys, right there and right there. And there's Joseph, and there's Nicodemus. Look at that. He got his halo. The artist decided he deserves one now. Here's what I want you to take away from this. Be the dynamic character. As your story continues, allow yourself to change as you learn, even if you're the only one. Grow and progress. Ask questions, and then ask again. If you don't get it, keep asking. Admit you don't know. God doesn't fear your questions. The gospel can handle any question that you have. It isn't in danger. And just because you believed something at one time, it doesn't mean you're stuck there. You could very well have been wrong. You may have been obsessing about something that's minor or ignoring something that's life-changing. Ask questions and then ask again. You're going to be moved in ways that you don't expect. You need to let the wind take you. The wind blows where it pleases. The Spirit of God goes where it pleases. However set you believe your life to be, however steady, when the Spirit says move, anybody know the song? You got to move. Be honest about who you are. Even though Jesus told Nicodemus the life of a spiritual person is unpredictable, Nicodemus did not get in trouble for being a religious man. He did not get in trouble for being a man of power or a man of distinction. Jesus talked to him where he was. He answered his questions in ways that would make him think. He challenged him as a teacher and as a master, a man who's supposed to understand a lot. He gave him very cryptic answers to mull over. And it took him, apparently, 2 years to get all of that worked out. It was okay for Nicodemus to be the teacher and the master. Jesus talked to him where he was. And Jesus called Nicodemus to new things. Jesus will start where you are and take you to new things. Let's pray, and then we're going to sing. God, thank you so much for the stories that we've been left with. Thank you for the example of real people who struggled, real people who thought they were safe and who realized they needed to open themselves up to be moved. Thank you for giving us just little bits of character that we can relate to and that we can grab hold of. Be with us as we sing and as we go. Amen.